That's all there is to say on the matter. People can't just go changing their personalities willy-nilly when they're middle-aged. Suddenly, Enigma snaps her fingers triumphantly. Ah! I know what this is all about. It's the change. Oh, Lord, Mama, I'm not menopausal. Enigma surveys her daughter through narrowed eyes. She looks different. Skinnier. She leans forward and points with an accusing finger. Margaret Ann, you've lost weight. Margie sighs. Well, yes, Mum, I've lost 2 stone. I'm nearly at my goal weight. Can't believe you haven't noticed before. Well, I don't look at you when I see you every day, do I? No need to get offended. I expect you do have the menopause. Your face is quite pink. That's because I'm feeling frustrated. I think we should cancel the anniversary this year as a mark of respect to Connie. Enigma cries, Connie would never want the anniversary cancelled. I guess that's true. Margie smiles slightly. Her face is thinner, notices Enigma. It makes everything about her seem more definite. Well, I've organized everything for the night, Mum. The staff are really very competent, you know. It will all run like clockwork. And the whole family will be there. Rose, Thomas and Debbie, Veronica, Grace and Callum, Sophie. You won't even notice I'm not there. And Enigma decides to hold off, bursting into tears. Of course I'll notice. Both my daughters deserting me. What will people think? My parents deserted me 73 years ago, and now my daughters do the same thing. It's true. Enigma is pleased to feel a genuine tickling sensation in her nose as she considers how poorly she has been treated. It sounds like you're starting to believe your own publicity, Mum. I beg your pardon, I don't know what that means. Are you trying to sound sophisticated or something? All I know is that the anniversary is very important to me. Is it? Margie looks at her mother curiously. But why? What do you mean, why? It's a special family event. We have fun, and it's about my life, isn't it? Oh, Mum, let's be honest. The anniversary is about business. It's about cash flow. Enigma carefully pulls out her hanky from her handbag and takes a deep, shuddery breath. It's time for tears. Chapter 39. I am searching for any information relating to the disappearance of Alice and Jack Munro on Scribbly Gum Island on the 15th of July 1932. I am especially interested in meeting anyone who knew the Munros or who had parents or grandparents who knew them. Possible monetary reward for quality information. Please contact Veronica Gordon at veronica.gordon@hotmail.com.au. Veronica puts down her pen and blows her nose. She is at the tail end of her flu and still feels a little weak and lightheaded. She ended up having to stay at Aunt Connie's house with Sophie for 2 days. She could barely walk. Sophie had made her chicken soup and even rubbed Vicks on her back, which Veronica found soothing, as well as disturbing. Hello? Veronica looks up suspiciously. A girl with shiny black hair stands in front of her, holding a coffee mug and a plate with a large Florentine biscuit. She says, I know you from the gym. Boxer size for the broken-hearted. It's that annoying Asian girl who always kicks with the wrong leg or punches with the wrong arm. Veronica says, Oh, yes, I recognize you. I'm so uncoordinated in that class. Well, yes, you are, says Veronica. I'm not sure if I'm broken-hearted anymore, but the class is still fun, isn't it? Shall I join you? Before Veronica has a chance to say anything, the girl is sitting at her table, putting her coffee and biscuit down, flicking back her hair. What's that you're working on? It's an ad I'm putting in the paper. A personal ad? The girl dimples at her. Well, no. I'm trying to solve a mystery. Aren't we all? Want some of my biscuit? All right. Veronica takes a bite of the biscuit. It's delicious, sweet and crunchy. The girl raises her eyebrows at Veronica over the rim of her coffee mug. Her almond-shaped eyes are so dark, they're almost black. Her fingers on the handle of her mug are long and fragile, like an artist's. She bites her nails. She's wearing a ring with a tiny green stone. Veronica has the funniest, most exhilarating feeling that a far more interesting mystery than Alice and Jack is about to be solved. Sophie is in her dressing gown, getting ready for her first date with Ian, the sweet solicitor, when Grace turns up unexpectedly. The baby is in a sling against her chest, a dimpled, tiny hand clutching Grace's shirt. "Hello, Jake! Look at you!" Sophie, besotted as always, runs a finger along the curve of his creamy, flushed cheek. His brown eyes rest inquisitively on Sophie and then dart away, intrigued by something over her shoulder. "Are you going out?" asks Grace abruptly. There are purplish shadows under her eyes, which would make anyone else look haggard. They make Grace look ethereal. "It's my first date with Aunt Connie's lawyer tonight," says Sophie, feeling both juvenile and ancient. Here is Grace, at least 5 years younger than her, a mother and a wife, while Sophie is still going out on first dates. "I'm sorry," says Grace. "I won't stay then. I just wanted to talk to you about something." "Oh, well, come in. I've got time for a quick cup of tea. I'm getting ready hours too early, of course." Why must she always babble in Grace's presence? "Did your headache get better yesterday?" Grace lifts Jake from his sling. "Would you like to hold him? I can make the tea." "Oh, of course." So Sophie is in the middle of trying to make the baby laugh by blowing raspberries against his tummy, messing up her carefully blow-dried hair, when Grace makes her announcement. "I'm thinking of leaving Callum." "Grace!" Sophie feels a thud of fear, guilt, and beneath it all, a tiny, quickly suppressed twinge of excitement. "Don't say anything to him, please. Will you promise not to say anything?" "Of course." Wonderful. More promises to keep secrets that probably shouldn't be kept. "But you've got to talk about this to him. He adores you, Grace." "No, he doesn't. Not really." "I expect it's just both of you adjusting to the new baby. Everybody says it's such a difficult time." "We've been having problems for ages." "Oh." Sophie doesn't know what to say. She doesn't have the same sort of relationship with Grace as she does with her other girlfriends. With them, she'd be firing questions and getting every detail. But Grace is so forbidding. "What about the baby?" she says finally, thinking of how much Callum adores his son. "He'd be devastated if Grace took Jake away." "I don't know yet." comments Jake cheerfully, trying hard to put his big toe in his mouth. Sophie can see his whole future in an instant, being shuttled back and forth between two homes, overhearing Mum and Dad snarling at each other about child support, hating Mummy's new boyfriend, although perhaps rather liking Daddy's lovely new girlfriend. "Oh, stop it. This isn't a game. This is a marriage." "What about counselling?" she asks Grace. I've got two lots of friends seeing the same counsellor at the moment. Apparently he's very good, and he gives you receipts that say professional development, so you can claim it as a tax deduction. I'll get you his number. Actually, I can get you his number right now if you want. Grace looks horrified by the offer. No, I don't want to talk about it with anyone. I just thought I'd tell you. Actually, I won't stay. I'll just go. Have a good night. She lifts the baby from Sophie's arms and is gone before the kettle begins to boil. Grace walks back up the hill, Jake's warm body swinging against her chest, her heart thudding. Well, she sure does like your dad, Jake. She'll treat him differently now she knows I'm thinking of leaving. I've given her permission to touch his arm, to hold eye contact. I've opened the door just a fraction, just enough to get them underway. You'll all three be very happy together. You'll have a lovely mummy and daddy. I'll give them 2 more weeks. I can manage 2 more weeks. Up until the anniversary. I'll get the tax returns done so Callum doesn't have to worry about it. Paperwork gives him eczema. I hope Sophie is good with paperwork. Have all the washing up to date. I'll leave lots of food in the freezer. Sophie only seems to make cakes, and they're not very good. But I guess Margie will help cook for them. There'll be that life insurance payout, so that will be handy. It will look like an accident. She takes a deep breath of the cold air. Yes, she feels better than she has in weeks. Ian, the sweet solicitor, doesn't put a first date foot wrong. He is charming and intelligent, not sickeningly smooth, but attentive and sweet. He clears his throat when they are given a table next to the kitchen's constantly swinging door and courteously but firmly asks if they can be moved. Sophie likes both the nervy clearing of the throat and the firmness. She asks him about the scar under his eye. "I wish I'd got it fighting a duel," he says, "or at least playing some sort of rugged, masculine sport. But it's actually a chicken pox scar from when I was 11. "Chicken pox?" cries Sophie. "It's not even a nice disease. Would it help if I nearly died from it?" "Nope. It's too itchy to ever be romantic." He has no problem with Sophie choosing the wine. He asks questions about her life, but doesn't demand to know who she votes for or why she's still single or whether she likes oral sex. He is interested in her work without being patronizing. He doesn't show off. He is nice to their waitress. He has nice hands. He doesn't grip his knife and fork or stick his elbows out. He drives an expensive car, but doesn't appear to be in love with it. He is divorced, but doesn't seem bitter and weird about it. He kisses her goodnight, and it's lovely, and he smells divine. His tongue doesn't slither in and out of her mouth like an eager lizard. His teeth don't smash against hers. "I'll call," he says, and she knows that he will. Ian, the sweet solicitor, is an absolute catch. As she drifts off to sleep, she thinks of Callum and Grace. Their relationship probably began with a perfect first date like this. And now look. That night she dreams she's in bed with Ian. He's lying on one elbow, smiling down at her, and Sophie is trying to hide her revulsion because he's covered in horrible chickenpox spots. "He's just a poxy lawyer," says Callum, sitting on the end of her bed, holding Jake. Sophie laughs and laughs. Chapter 40. Rose serenely tucks her long white hair under her hot pink floral bathing cap while Sophie jiggles up and down on the cold, hard sand, rubbing her goosebumpy arms and saying, Don't you think we might be at risk of hypothermia this morning, Rose? It will be lovely and bracing, darling. Rose slowly begins to walk towards the water. Her back is milky white, with purple age spots. Her spine long and knobbly. Sophie can see the memory of a young girl's beautiful, athletic body in the length of her legs. Rose gets to the same mossy green rock she always chooses and dives straight in, with barely a splash, emerging to do a graceful freestyle. The woman is nearly 90. Sighing, Sophie follows. The first heart-stopping shock of the water when she dives in always makes her inwardly scream, "Never again! Never do this again!" She comes up gasping, teeth chattering, flailing about with her nose high above the water, like a puppy. After a few minutes, she calms down and remembers why she keeps doing this. The water silky against her skin, the bay gradually becoming brighter and sharper as the sun rises higher in the sky, and the fact that she will still be burning fat for an hour after this swim. So the hot chocolate and egg and bacon pastries she and Rose will have for breakfast will be like eating nothing. The pastries were originally cooked by Connie. Apparently, Rose's deep freeze is still stacked high with food cooked by Connie. Rose defrosts them each night, heats them up in the oven before their swim, and they're still warm by the time they're ready to eat. Sophie keeps offering to take a turn at bringing the breakfast, but Rose just laughs, as if she's making a joke. After their swim, they wrap up in warm jumpers and beanies and sit on the sand to eat. "How was your outing with Connie's lawyer fellow?" asks Rose.
"It was fun, actually."
"Do you think he could be Mr. Wright?"
"Maybe."
She wishes she could get that stupid dream out of her mind. Whenever she thinks of Ian, she imagines him covered in chickenpox spots. It's very unfair.
"Well, don't rush. You've got to hold out for the right one."
"I can't be too fussy. I'm getting on. I'll end up an..." Oh, God, she was about to say old maid. And she is talking to an old maid. The thought of hurting sweet, fragile Rose's feelings makes Sophie feel ill. A blistering blush shoots up her neck. The blush feels hotter and redder than usual on her cold, wet skin. Fortunately, Rose just keeps looking at the river, steadily sipping her hot chocolate. She says, "Connie said I was too fussy. She was always trying to match me up with someone."
"And you didn't like any of them?" asks Sophie.
"Not really. I thought I was in love with a fairly nice chap sometime in the 60s. What year was it? I remember Connie was marching in the Vietnam protests. 1966? No, it was 1967, but I went off him after a while. To be honest, I was quite relieved. I was getting set in my ways by then. I didn't want to be cooking and cleaning for some man. He drowned a few years later. So that was lucky, eh?"
"Maybe not for him."
Rose chuckles. "No, not for him." Sophie has seen black and white photos of Rose when she was a young girl, with long hair, smooth skin, and elusive eyes. Is life really so horribly arbitrary that some people just never get around to meeting the right person? Here's Sophie thinking that her life is a romantic comedy and there's no way the director will let her finish up alone because the test audiences would hate that. But, in fact, it could happen. It could just accidentally, capriciously happen. "Of course, I was such a silly, dreamy young girl," reflects Rose. "One day, I saw this fabric in the window of David Jones, and I wanted it so badly. It was crepe de chine, a beautiful, deep, rich turquoise color.
the same colour as the river on a bright sunny day. I could see the dress I would make. I needed about 2.5 yards to make a dress. It was going to cost me £2.30. That was an awful lot of money. We were doing it very rough, not like now. We're very rich now. Did you know we were rich? It's lovely being rich. I recommend it. And all thanks to Connie. Anyway, the thing was, I couldn't get that fabric out of my mind. I was quite obsessed with it. I used to dream about it. I had to find a way to make £2.30. And then... Oh, dear, darling. I'm not meant to be telling you this story until you're 40, am I? Enigma will be so cross with me. Are you 40? I'm very nearly 40, Sophie says hopefully. Oh, sugar, says Rose. I can't tell you any more. Enigma already thinks I'm losing my marbles. Can you at least tell me if you got the fabric? Begs Sophie. Rose smiles. Yes, I did. But I never made the dress. And this is somehow related to Alice and Jack's disappearance? Of course. It's how it all started. When we take you up to Kingfisher Lookout on your 40th birthday, Connie will say, "We've got something to tell you about Alice and Jack. It all started with some green material that Rose just had to have." Green material. It was turquoise crepe de chine. Oh, dear. But this is terrible. I shouldn't be telling you any of this. I don't know what's come over me lately. I've been feeling a little wild, as if I want to break all the rules. I wonder if I'm about to die, like Connie. You're a picture of health. This is so tempting, thinks Sophie. The solution to the Alice and Jack mystery is right there, hovering on the tip of Rose's tongue. All she needs is the gentlest nudge, and Sophie could know it all. But it seems so cruel and thuggish, like capturing a butterfly. Of course, if Veronica was here, she'd be tearing its wings off by now. Did you know that Veronica is determined to solve the mystery and write a book about it? Sophie warns Rose. She's even talking about getting some forensic expert to do DNA testing on the bloodstains on the kitchen floor. No need for testing. It's Connie's blood. She bled all over the place that day. What a mess. Oh, sugar. Rose clamps her hand over her mouth. Her eyes dance. I'm being so naughty today. Sophie puts her hands over her ears. I'm not listening to another word you say. Rose giggles. Thank you, darling. I appreciate it. Have some more hot chocolate. Chapter 41. Sophie walks towards the ferry wharf to meet Rick, the gorgeous gardener, for their picnic lunch. She feels quite pretty and appropriate and nowhere near 40. For once, she has on exactly the right outfit for the occasion. A striped, subtly sailorish, flattering to the waist top with crisp white leg-lengthening pants and flat, stylish, outdoorsy girl shoes. Her hair is up in a bouncy, breezy ponytail. It's refreshing to go on a date without her stomach clenching, without trying not to think, is this it? Is this my chance? Will this change everything? What's come over her? She doesn't care less whether Rick likes her or not. There is Ian, after all. Someone is jogging up the hill towards her. She sees that it's Callum, and now her stomach does clench with an idiotic, pleased anticipation, which irritates her. Would you stop it? It's just his unavailability making him seem appealing. She's acting just like a man. Callum is wearing a singlet top and baggy shorts, and his face is all wrinkled with that frenzied, pained look that runners get. She waves, and when he reaches her, he stops, bending forward and resting his hands on his knees.
Good. An excuse to stop, he puffs. I'm not a runner. I'm just pretending to be one.
You fooled me, says Sophie. He straightens up. Where are you off to? You look nice.
On my date with Rick.
The turtle-tattooed gardener.
That's the one.
Hey, Sophie.
Yes?
Has Grace said anything to you lately about...
anything?
Oh, nothing much. Only that you were never really right for her and she's thinking of leaving you.
She hedges.
You need to be a bit more specific.
What do you mean by anything?
His face does an awkward spasm.
Anything about us, I guess. She's said some really strange things lately. I can't get her to talk to me. I thought maybe, well, you know, women always reveal their deepest secrets to each other. I'm not asking you to betray a confidence or anything. Although, of course, I am. Aren't I?
He tries to look flippant, but only manages to look deeply unhappy. Sophie aches for him.
I don't really know Grace that well, says Sophie.
No, sorry, of course you don't. Forget we had this conversation. It must be the unexpected rush of oxygen to the brain from exercising.
I'd better go.
Have fun. Be back by curfew, young lady.
He taps at his watch, but he's too miserable to be funny. His face sags.
Okay, bye.
She watches him go pounding off. For the first time, she feels a flood of bitchy feelings towards Grace.
You're beautiful. You're talented. You've got a gorgeous baby, a gorgeous husband who adores you, and you're actually considering just throwing it all away because you fight about housework.
Well, more fool you, Grace.
More fool you.
Rick, the gorgeous gardener, is wearing a white T-shirt under a blue V-necked jumper and jeans. When Sophie goes to step into the boat from the wharf, he doesn't just give her an arm. He lifts her by the waist and places her in the boat, as if this is perfectly normal behavior. He takes her to a private beach about 20 minutes down the river, only accessible by boat. He's brought the picnic, a bottle of white wine and slab-like tomato and cheese sandwiches. The wine wouldn't have been Sophie's choice, and the sandwiches are not especially nice. He's cut everything too thick and put too much pepper on the tomato. They're like sandwiches made by a schoolboy. She has to swill a lot of wine to get the sandwich down. Her head starts to feel pleasantly fuzzy.
Very nice, she says with relief once she's finished her last mouthful.
Really? He doesn't look convinced. A woman once told me I was such a bad cook, I even ruined sandwiches.
Sophie widens her eyes innocently.
That's extraordinary because that was one of the tastiest cheese and tomato sandwiches I have ever eaten.
He grins.
Liar. I'll make you eat another one if you keep that up. It's very different from her date with Ian, the sweet solicitor. Ian belonged to Sophie's Sydney world. They talked the same language. They'd been to the same films, plays, festivals, and restaurants. They'd even discovered a mutual acquaintance. Whereas Rick, the gorgeous gardener, doesn't get into town very much, doesn't even own a television, and can't actually remember the last movie he saw. Ian has skied in Aspen and scuba dived in the Maldives. Rick spent 6 months meditating in a Buddhist monastery in China.
Ian admitted to skim-reading certain Booker Prize-winning novels so he could talk about them if necessary at dinner parties. Rick only ever reads non-fiction. Biographies, histories, and National Geographic. I like facts, he says, leaning back against a tree and stretching out long legs. He makes Sophie feel frivolous and pretty and about 14 years old. He makes her feel like suggesting they play a game of chasing and letting him catch her. After a while, there is a pause in their conversation, and for some reason, neither of them break it. They just look at each other. It appears they're having a staring competition, like in primary school, to see who will giggle first. Sophie's mouth twitches, but she restrains herself. Rick's eyes crease slightly, but his face stays immobile. They stare and stare. Now it seems to be turning into a weird sort of foreplay. Finally, to her own astonishment, she finds herself reaching over and taking the wine glass from his hand and putting it carefully on the ground without breaking eye contact. She puts her hand on the back of his neck. For the first time in her entire life, she is initiating the first kiss. Various girlfriends applaud in her head. About time. Rick gets the idea and takes over pretty fast, and fortunately he doesn't kiss like a Buddhist monk. She is all melty and trembly and clawing pathetically at his clothes. This goes on for some time until finally they pull away from each other. I cooked chocolate biscuits for dessert, says Rick. Sophie wipes her mouth and readjusts her clothing. She feels ridiculous. Was it necessary to act so eager? She's practically a middle-aged woman. She acted like she was gagging for it, which she was. Oh, and of course, here we go. Is that a blush? Rick touches her cheek with his fingertips. Are you doing that on purpose to charm me? Rick, the gorgeous gardener, just like Ian, the sweet solicitor, is unquestionably a catch. Chapter 42. The Trevi Fountain, Rome, at sunset. Dear Grace, it's hot, noisy, and very crowded here. I've been getting terrible migraines. Two people from our group had their wallets stolen today. I've been keeping a good grip on my handbag. The gelato on Scribbly Gum is superior to any gelato I've eaten in Italy, and as for the pizza here, I can assure you, it's nothing special. Much too bland. We're lucky that Australia is so clean, aren't we? The men stare very rudely, which I find quite disconcerting. Never thought I'd miss Australian males. Our guide became quite snappy today and said I needed to embrace the cultural differences. Obviously, he doesn't like Rome any better than me. How is Jake? Is he teething yet? I can't remember when they teeth. I was thinking on the bus today about when you were a baby. One night, you cried for 2 hours straight. I was at my wit's end. I walked over to Connie's place and handed you over to Jimmy. You stopped crying instantly. I was so furious with you. I felt like you'd done it on purpose. Silly of me. Love, Mum. P.S. I hope you're well, Callum. Laura. Your mother seems to be doing a lot of reflecting while she's away, comments Callum, putting the postcard back down on the coffee table. Yes, she's become bizarrely chatty. Grace is ironing while Callum watches Australian Idol on television. Grace hates Australian Idol. Sophie loves it and has animated discussions with Callum about who they think should win, as if it actually matters. Relax, Callum had said when he saw Grace setting up the ironing board, or let me do it. He's a terrible ironer, energetically ironing in wrinklier wrinkles and missing whole sections. Besides which, Grace doesn't want to sit down and watch television. It makes her anxious to think of sitting still. Her heart pumps and her hands tremble as if she's had too much coffee. Move, move, move. Get this done. Get that done. Soon it will be over. All these anecdotes about my childhood, she says to Callum. It's infuriating. Really? Why? I thought it was sort of nice. She's putting on an act, playing the mother role. That seems a bit harsh. You don't know her. Well, I'm hardly likely to know anything about my mother-in-law, am I, when I don't know anything about my wife? He keeps making clumsy, nervy digs like this, trying to pretend their argument the other day had been over something trivial. Except he can't carry it off. The inflections of his voice are all wrong, and his eyes are still bruised and hurt. To distract him, she says, When I was 10, my mother didn't say a single word to me for 21 days. Callum turns his head away from the television and speaks in his normal voice. You're kidding. It was her special brand of discipline. She would just look right through me as if I literally wasn't there. She was very good at it. Sometimes I'd be begging her to stop it, crying, yelling at her, anything just to get her to talk to me again. And she'd just be humming this little tune to herself. I became invisible. It was quite a performance. If it was just a small offense, she'd stop talking to me for a day. But if it was something really bad, she might not talk to me for weeks. That was the longest. 21 days. I ticked them off in my diary. But that's terrible. Well, she never laid a finger on me. Uncle Ron used to give Veronica and Thomas terrible beltings. I'd take the beltings any day. Grace shrugs. As she bends over to lift another one of Callum's shirts from the ironing basket, a great weight of tiredness makes her knees buckle. Callum has turned down the sound on the television. He is far more interested in this topic of conversation than she had intended. What had you done when she didn't talk to you for 21 days? I left a banana at the bottom of my school bag. It turned into black pulp, and Mum was just disgusted. I can still see the expression on her face when she saw it. It was like she'd found a body. A banana? Every kid does that. I never did it again. Callum is all spluttering fascination. I can't believe your mother didn't speak to you for 3 weeks because you left a banana in your bag. So what, you'd come home from school and she wouldn't even say hello? What if you said sorry? If you tried to talk to her? It didn't make any difference what I did. She was like the guards at Buckingham Palace. She looked right through me. Until all of a sudden, one day, it would be over, and she'd be talking to me normally again. Grace flips Callum's shirt and runs the iron across the collar. She remembers how on the 5th day after the banana incident, she'd forgotten her mother wasn't speaking and went running into the house and started telling her the amazing goosebumpy news that her painting of Aunt Connie and Aunt Rose swimming at Sultana Rocks had come first in an inter-school competition. Her mother was sitting on the sofa reading a copy of Vogue, and Grace was chatting, bubbling over with the story, when she realized Laura hadn't even lifted her head. She just flipped the page and kept right on reading her article, while Grace's words trailed humiliatingly away. I think that's a terrible thing to do to a child. Callum looks at her seriously, almost pleadingly, as if he wants something of her.
What? She can't give it to him, whatever it is.
She says, it's hardly the worst thing that a mother can do.
Well, what if you'd hurt yourself?
Grace buttons the freshly ironed shirt onto a coat hanger. Actually, sometimes I thought about purposely hurting myself to get a reaction, but... She really can't be bothered finishing the sentence. She really can't be bothered having this conversation. Why doesn't he just turn the television back up and stop tiring her?
But what?
It was when Grace was 13 and her mother wasn't talking to her because she'd got hot pink nail polish on the dining room table. Grace decided to prove that silent time could be shattered, that it wasn't something real, that she really did exist even during those times when her mother pretended she didn't. She bought a sesame bar. She didn't buy it at the school because all the ladies in the tuck shop knew about her nut allergy, and if she'd asked for a sesame bar, they would have clutched their hearts in horror. If Grace ate a sesame bar, she would die, a fact that kids and grown-ups alike seemed to relish. Grace's plan was to sit down at the dinner table and say, "Mum, I'm going to eat this whole sesame bar unless you say something to me." And then she was going to open it and slowly take a bite, very slowly, to give Laura time to react, to scream, "No, Grace, stop." The procedure during silent time was that her mother made enough dinner for the two of them, but Grace had to serve herself. She didn't need to eat at the table during silent time. She could eat in her room or in front of the television or sitting cross-legged on the laundry floor. In fact, it didn't even make any difference whether Grace took the plate of food and upended it on the kitchen floor. She knew this because she'd tried it once, and her mother didn't even flinch, which was terrifying because it must have been torture for her. But surely she wouldn't let her daughter kill herself. Grace sat at the opposite side of the table to her mother and carefully laid the sesame bar down next to her bowl of chicken pasta and her glass of orange juice. Her mother's eyes didn't flicker. She just continued to eat her pasta, her lipsticked mouth chewing and digesting ladylike mouthfuls. "I'm going to eat this," said Grace. And her voice, which she had hoped would sound determined and mature, came out tentative and babyish. Laura's vague, friendly gaze just skimmed straight over her, as if she were no more interesting than a chair. Grace picked up the sesame bar. Her heart was thudding. Her mother dabbed at the corner of her mouth with her serviette. Grace tore open the packaging. Her mother reached over for the pepper grinder and put some more black pepper on her pasta. Grace held the sesame bar in front of her mouth. She nearly retched at the thought. Her mother yawned, a genuine, slightly bored yawn. And Grace thought, she's going to let me die right in front of her. She took the sesame bar to the rubbish bin, and then she scrubbed her hands to ensure there was no trace of sesame seed left. She took the chicken penne up to her room and climbed into bed and ate it there. 3 days later, her mother said, "I think it's going to rain," when she came down to breakfast, and her punishment had ended. Now, 20 years later, as Grace irons, her grown-up mind thinks with bitter amusement, "She won the bluff. Of course she would have stopped me." But another, less certain part of her still wonders, would she have let me die to prove a point? Callum still hasn't turned the television back up. "I can't believe you've never told me this." "It's not that interesting. I don't know how your parents disciplined you. My father roared at me, and my mother chased me around the house, brandishing whatever she happened to have in her hand. They didn't ignore me for days on end. He's looking at her with what Grace takes to be revulsion, at yet another example of her strange, cold family life, compared to his rowdy, messy, cheerful childhood. "Can you turn it back up?" she says. But instead he stands up. "Grace. Sweetheart." He reaches out a tentative hand to touch her face. "Now you're blocking the television," says Grace, and presses the steam button so the iron hisses. Chapter 43.
"Have you told your husband yet?"
"No. I haven't told my wife either. My husband would just sneer at me. My wife would just laugh at me. Well, we'll show her. Maybe. I hope so." "You're not losing your nerve, are you?" "Not after we've come this far."
Chapter 44. Ron is sitting in his study, desultorily working on some overdue paperwork, when he is pleased to remember that it's the first of the month, which means he can flip over the page on his albeit lingerie calendar. The picture for May is of a skirt flying up to reveal a G-stringed bottom. And while it's a very appealing, professional piece of photography, it will be interesting to see what June has to offer. Under no circumstances can he flick ahead. He takes pride in such small, secret acts of self-denial. They build character. He has tried to explain the importance of delaying gratification to Margie, but she only pretends to be interested, while stuffing more and more food down her cake hole. The calendar was a Christmas gift from a supplier. When Ron's daughter Veronica saw it hanging up in his study, she became unexpectedly feral. They had a ferocious argument about it. She was completely irrational, of course. It never ceases to amaze him, the stunning lack of logic in women's brains. For Christ's sake, it's not like he put it up in the dining room. Besides which, this isn't something you'd see hanging up in a mechanics workshop. It's a limited edition collector's item. It's tasteful. It's elegant. The photos are in black and white. "Oh, what would you know about art, Dad?" Veronica's lips had curled. "This is soft porn. It's insulting to Mum. It objectifies and degrades women." "Don't upset your father, darling," Margie had said. "It doesn't worry me. It's very pretty." "Well, it should worry you." Veronica had sounded like she was close to tears and stormed out of the room, leaving Ron to wonder out loud whether his daughter was actually stable. It beggars belief that this intense, contemptuous, skinny woman is the same toddler who used to be so excited when he came home from work that she spun in circles, shrieking, "Daddy home! Daddy home!" Sometimes Veronica makes him feel strangely inferior, strangely lower class, and that's not right. Australia is a classless society. Egalitarian. He is pleased to remember the word. Egalitarian. An upper-class, well-educated sort of word. He may be the son of a fitter and turner, but he can use words like egalitarian. No problem at all. Just because Veronica has all the benefits of the university education that Ron missed out on. A university education he damn well paid for. To be scrupulously honest, the island paid for it. But still, I'll forget it. He'll never understand her. Ron takes down the calendar and reverently flips the page to reveal a photo of a woman with her arms raised above her head as she pulls off her sweater. Her uplifted breasts are encased in a lacy bra. Isn't the lighting sort of moody? Grainy? Doesn't that make it art? What does soft porn actually mean? Didn't Rembrandt or somebody or other paint nudes? What's the difference? Just because he's dead and French. Was he French? The fucking French. He must look Rembrandt up on the internet. He should do an art history course or something. The phone rings, and he answers while still studying the woman's breasts. Hi, Dad. Ron drops the calendar on his desk as if it's hot. Hello, Veronica. How are you? What are you doing? She is sounding unusually light-hearted. Just paperwork, love. He is irritated by how wrong-footed he is feeling. Do you want to speak to your mother? Oh, okay. No time to chat, I see. Well, is she there? Actually, I don't think she is. She's out. That's annoying. I wanted to tell her something. Something to do with the Munro baby mystery. What is it? No. I'll tell Mum. Oh, well, the Alice and Jack business is nothing to do with me. He takes a light tone, but knows that he is sounding jocular and middle-aged. Strictly women in charge. It's a wonder they let men on the island. Veronica ignores this. Mum's always out these days, she says. Where is she? He searches his mind and comes up blank. I don't know. Weight Watchers? I don't think so. Not at this time. I'd be worried if I were you, Dad. Maybe she's having an affair now she's getting so trim, taut and terrific. Ron has no idea what she's talking about. Veronica says, I hope you've been complimenting her on how good she looks. Ron sighs. What? Has she changed her hair colour or something and I didn't notice? Dad! Veronica explodes and sounds more like her normal self. Are you telling me you haven't noticed that Mum has dropped 3 dress sizes? You're unbelievable. Do you even look at her? All that sniping about her weight, and then you don't even notice. God! You're probably too busy getting off on that pathetic pornographic calendar of yours to even look at your own wife. I wouldn't blame her if she was having an affair. Is that just a pause for breath, or have you finished? Yes, I've finished. God! Just tell her I called when she gets home, and take a second to look at her. I'll see you at the anniversary. Yes, all right. Ron puts down the phone. He picks up the calendar and puts it back on the hook. He is used to Veronica's outbursts, but this one has left him with a vague sense of disquiet. He crosses his arms behind his head and stretches back in his chair. So Margie has been losing weight. About bloody time. She could have told him. She tells him everything else, babbles on about all sorts of irrelevant crap. Wasn't it a bit strange that she hadn't mentioned she'd lost weight? Was it some sort of trick? It is true that she has been out a lot lately. Actually, he's barely seen her over the last few weeks. She must have told him where she was going tonight, but he hadn't really registered it. He knows Veronica was only joking about her mother having an affair, but thinking about it gives him a strangely familiar sort of jolt deep in his gut. It's not necessarily an unpleasant sensation. It's a nervy, adrenaline-filled feeling like he used to get before a rugby game. He looks at June girl's breasts and identifies the feeling exactly. It was the summer of 1967. The Prime Minister, Harold Holt, had just vanished while surfing on a Victorian beach. His body was never found, and everybody was talking conspiracy theories, but Ron couldn't have cared less about whether it was the Mafia or Martians who took off with Harold, any more than he cared what had happened to Alice and Jack Munro. He was fixated on one goal, Margie McNab, the prettier, in his opinion, of the somewhat renowned Scribbly Gum Island sisters, daughters of the Alice and Jack baby. There were at least three other guys vying for Margie, and Ron was determined to be the last one standing. He wasn't necessarily the best-looking or even the smartest of the three of them, but he knew exactly how to play it. When to come on strong with the charm, when to pull back and be a bit cool, when to be funny, when to be sensitive. He didn't consider it a done deal until the day he triumphantly slid that diamond ring on her finger. Then he knew he could relax and concentrate on other things, like work and sailing. Margie, he remembered, used to wear a red crochet bikini, which used to send him bananas. Her breasts in that red bikini outclassed all the girls on his albeit calendar. It was in the 80s that she started to really pile on the weight. It seemed to happen so fast. One day, he woke up with a fat wife. Not a chubby wife, a fat wife. He didn't like it, and that made him the bad guy. Apparently it's the worst thing in the world to comment on your wife's weight, even while she balloons before your fucking eyes. You can't say, "Are you sure you need that second piece of cake?" You can't even say, "Maybe we both should eat a bit healthier." No, you're meant to just pretend to be equally attracted to her now she weighs as much as a small truck as when she wore a red crochet bikini. The only solution is to try and avoid looking directly at her as much as possible. That's why he hasn't noticed she's lost weight. It's not his fault. Does he still love her? It's not something he's bothered to think about much. She aggravates him, certainly. Sometimes he can feel his nerves begin to chafe the moment she opens her mouth. But he still thinks nothing tastes as good as Margie's cheese and mushroom omelette. He still automatically rubs the soles of her feet when she puts them on his lap while they're watching television, although maybe it's been a while since she's done that. He still remembers how he felt watching her cry her heart out at her dad's funeral. Margie was always such a daddy's girl, and it made him want to punch something because there was nothing he could bloody well do to fix it for her. They haven't had sex for months, but he's never been unfaithful to her. Except in his mind. And who could blame him for that? He does give her a pretty hard time sometimes. But she just takes it. No matter how far he goes with it, she just keeps on smiling and blinking until he wants to scream, "Are you still in there, Margie?" The thing is, even though he knows that Veronica was only joking, if some guy, for whatever reason, maybe if he had some sort of fetish for fat women, tried to come on to Margie, then she could easily fall for some pathetic line. She's so gullible, a hopeless judge of character. The way she repeats what tradesmen tell her with such wide-eyed respect. To his own surprise, Ron finds himself suddenly banging an agitated fist on his desk so hard that his jar of paperclips rattles. It's past 10 on a Tuesday night. Where the hell is she? Rose is sitting at Enigma's kitchen table separating eggs. She does it automatically, in quick, efficient movements. One sharp crack of the egg against the side of the bowl, yolk in one half of the shell, white in the other. Rose is working in an assembly line with Enigma and Margie, baking marble cakes for the anniversary. They'll be sold in special Alice and Jack anniversary souvenir boxes and sold at a premium, $30 a cake. Last year they sold over 100 on the night. Rose remembers Connie had rubbed her hands with joy after counting up the cash, as if she was still 19 years old and destitute, not 90 years old, with a share portfolio worth so much that Rose had to sit down the last time the accountant went through the figures with them. Those years of worrying about money and not having enough to eat had changed Connie forever, thought Rose. Food and money were her two obsessions until the day she died. And Jimmy, of course. And the island. She was an obsessive sort of woman, really.
"I just can't get over it," says Enigma. "Last night I woke up in the middle of the night thinking about it."
Another obsessive woman. Enigma is still sulking over the fact that Margie will be out on the night of the anniversary. That girl latches onto things like a pit bull terrier.
"I'll be back by midnight, Mum," says Margie, just like Cinderella.
"You shouldn't be going at all," mutters Enigma. Rose picks up another egg from the carton and observes Margie's new slimline figure.
"Margie," she says thoughtfully, "you're looking so pretty today. So slim."
"Humph," says Enigma. But Margie looks pink and pleased.
"Thank you, Aunt Rose. Guess what? Ron finally noticed that I'd lost weight. But he was very strange about it. He actually asked me if I was having an affair last night. He sounded a bit insecure."
"And are you?" asks Rose with interest.
Margie does seem a lot more confident these days. Someone has been putting that colour back in her cheeks.
Margie frowns down at her mixing bowl.
"Not exactly."
Enigma throws down her sieve with a puff of flour.
"How can you not exactly be having an affair? I certainly hope you're not. I never got to have an affair, did I? I would have quite liked to have had one at times too."
"Oh, Mum, how can you say that? Dad was a wonderful husband."
"He might have been a wonderful father to you, Margie, but you weren't married to him, so you have no idea if he was a wonderful husband. At times, I was bored silly. But did I rush out having affairs? No. I made myself a nice sherry, bought a new Mills and Boone, and put up with it."
Margie rolls her eyes at Rose.
"Listen to Mother Teresa." Enigma snaps. "I suppose that's meant to be what you lot call witty, huh? Do you see me laughing?"
"No, you don't." The oven timer goes off, and Margie puts down the beaters and goes to take out 4 marble cakes and put in 4 more.
"Aunt Connie would be pleased. We've sold out of tickets to the anniversary even earlier than last year," she comments. Obviously, she is not going to say anything more about the not exactly affair, thinks Rose. She will have to ask her another time.
"You know," says Rose, "I was thinking that we should make this our last ever anniversary celebration."
Margie and Enigma both stop what they're doing and turn to stare at her, thunderstruck.
"It's just so much effort, isn't it?" she says. "It's not like we need to make any more money."
"Connie would just die," says Enigma.
Rose and Margie exchange amused glances.
"Oh, I know she's already dead," cries Enigma. "I had noticed that, actually. I had noticed that everything is falling to pieces and everybody wants to change everything now she's dead."
Her face is working, ready to cry.
"I'm just raising the idea," says Rose soothingly. "I just sometimes think we don't need to make any more money from Alice and Jack. I think perhaps it's time to give it a rest."
"It's a family tradition," cries Enigma.
"It's a family business," says Rose. "A profitable family business."
"Well, we should keep it profitable for the children. I knew you were losing your marbles, Rose. We should take you to a doctor and ask him."